You can't stop it. It's coming to a town near you. It used to be called contemporary. Some call it relevant. We're so cool, we call it contemporvent.
It's postmodern, it's hip, it's new, it's contemporary, it's constantly changing. Doesn't mean much to us because nothing means much to us. We don't take ourselves seriously and we don't take the fact that we don't take anything seriously. And that's the way the postmodern age has played itself out. We don't fear anything, we feel nothing. It's a revolution, man. It's a revolution from year to year, from generation to generation. We're revolting against all the cultural patterns of everything we left behind. Folks, it's all new, it's a revolution, and it's affecting the way we do church. The last 20 to 30 years, folks, we've seen a revolution in music in the church. Think about it. A wild revolution is changing the way we've done music in the last 500 years, and it's happened just in the last 30 years of our lives. There's no question about that. There's been a humongous revolution. We don't worship the same way we worshiped in the 1960s, or the 1950s, or 1940s, or 1840s, or 1740s. Our worship has changed dramatically. Our music, our culture has changed dramatically in just the last 30 years. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Now that's a very important question. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Does this radical change in culture and music indicate a wonderful reformation and revival sweeping the church in America? Is that what it is? Or is it something else? Or is this just more of the breakdown of culture, of family, of faith that we're dealing with everywhere else in our culture today? These are really serious questions. I mean really serious questions. And I guess we're going to know the answer for sure in the next 40, 50, 60 years as the faith continues to collapse in church after church after church after church after church everywhere. But you better answer the question right now. Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? You need to answer it rightly because we're right in the midst of the incredible breakdown of the family, of the father-son relationships, of generational continuity, where grandchildren and great-grandchildren and grandparents are not worshiping in the same churches as they used to. Serious people need to ask the question, did we get our culture right? Did we get our music right? Will our children be stronger in the faith than we were because of the music? Because of the culture that we brought into the church. You better answer that question and answer it right. In just a moment, I'm going to speak with a man who's written a book on this subject, Dr. T. David Gordon, Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. We'll be back in just a moment. Back on the Generations Radio broadcast, Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. And the last 20, 30, 40 years has been a massive revolution, a wild revolution in music, especially in the church, friends. This revolution has infected the church in a tremendous way, far more than any other change we've seen in the last 500 years. And we're asking the question today, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? We are seeing certainly generational discontinuity in the culture, in the music of the church, and it's coming faster and faster and faster. And to talk about this with me is Dr. T. David Gordon. He's written a new book called Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Gordon to the radio program. Welcome, Dr. Gordon.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be here.
Dr. Gordon, you have watched the Christian faith, you've watched the Christian church move in a direction towards postmodernism, towards revolution in the culture and the music. How do you describe that? How would you describe it to, they say, a Martin Luther or a J.S. Bach, if you ran into him and had to explain what happened in the church between 1970 and 2010?
Well, you know, that would be the ideal person to explain it to in some ways, because I'm looking at the matter as a media ecologist, and what I would suggest is that our culture developed media that they had never heard of, and when I describe those media or technologies to them, they might think I was talking about magic, or pulling their leg for that matter, but that would make the point. Before you had electronic technologies, phonograph and radio, but especially radio, and the reason I say especially radio is because very few families had phonographs in the early years.
Hmm.
It was a fairly expensive thing. The radio was actually less expensive, and so all the way through the 1930s probably, a home would be more likely to have a radio than a phonograph. This causes two profound changes and people's sentiments about music, their sensibilities. First, before the radio or the phonograph, all music was live.
Mm-hmm.
All the music that you were exposed to, everything that affected your sensibilities regarding music was live. That either meant that you heard a performance live, or, what was equally common, if not more common, you sang it yourself.
Yes.
So folk music was the primary music that most people were exposed to in the West prior to, let's say, 1920 or 1930.
You didn't have pop stars singing this pop music in the 1910s or the 1880s.
No, because there was no broadcast. There's no way to broadcast.
Yes.
And so what happens is by the time you get to the 1930s, a critical mass of people in the United States have radios. And so broadcasting now can be the vehicle by which, for instance, FDR champions his presidency and explains to people his policies. He was the first president actually to use it in that fashion. It was the first of the mass media. But because it was a mass medium capable of reaching so much of the population, it was quickly put to commercial usages. And so the first thing that happens is music goes from being something that you participate in to something that someone else performs. That's one enormous change. The second change is, for commercial reasons, pop music becomes essentially the exclusive thing that is broadcast.
Yes.
They couldn't really broadcast much sacred music because ours is a land of freedom and not everyone had the same religion. And so that wasn't going to work. It might, in fact, alienate purchases of your product. And they couldn't do much classical music, though they began with that. The radio did begin with many classical broadcasts. But the problem with classical is it requires something of a learning curve. It's a little demanding to learn to listen to classical music.
Yes.
And if someone turned into to hear the radio and it was some tenor at New York singing opera, if he didn't have a taste for opera, he would turn the station to something else. And to what does he turn? Well, if you or I were producing commercial programming, we would want art that doesn't require a great learning curve to enjoy, and we would want art that can be quickly and cheaply produced.
Yes.
Which means that we'd exclude the Brahms Requiem, for instance, because it took Brahms 7 years to write that piece. He began shortly after Robert Schumann took his life and finished it shortly after his mother died. And so over 7 years passed for Brahms to perfect his Ein Deutsches Requiem.
Which we should say took longer than Elvis Presley to write You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog.
Took nearly longer than Elvis Presley to do his entire career.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And so what happens is really artistic, carefully artistically crafted music like that takes too long to produce, to fill the airways with it, and also it requires a bit of a learning curve. I love Brahms, for instance, but it took me several years of sort of concentrated attention to become a Brahms lover.
Mm.
And so what happened is pop music, which had actually been only a small part of the typical repertoire of most people to that time, to roughly 1920 to 1930, pop music within 30 or 40 years became the exclusive form of music to which most people are exposed.
Mm.
They hear it in the grocery store. They hear it in the Gap when they're shopping for jeans. They hear it when they're pumping gasoline into their car. They hear it when they're waiting to have their teeth filled. Almost everywhere we go, we have pop music in the background. And it is so pervasive then in our culture that for many people, it's the only thing that sounds like music. When some people say, for instance, then that they prefer contemporary music, sometimes, depending upon the relationship already established, I will say, now, do you mean you prefer it the way you prefer, let's say, chocolate ice cream to vanilla ice cream, and you've had probably an equal amount of both? Or do you mean you prefer it the way you prefer vanilla ice cream to pistachio, and you've never had pistachio before? Because that's a critical difference, it seems to me.
Right.
Most people who say they prefer contemporary music prefer it the way they prefer the English language. It's the only thing they've ever known.
Yes, and we have seen radical changes in that form of music, from Bing Crosby to Nat King Cole to Elvis Presley to Eminem and Katy Perry. The form of music, the style of music has changed dramatically and seems to change about every 2 to 5 years now. There's also this dramatic revolutionary effect that this music bears upon a society. It doesn't, isn't it?
Yeah, one of the things that I mentioned in the book is that the commercial forces for whom this is so important create a consumerist culture by selling two things. They sell their product, but before they sell their product, they sell a value. And that value then becomes the Archimedean lever by which they sell their product. And the value is new.
Yes.
The first commercial message I recall seeing as a young man was for Tide detergent back in the late 1950s, early 60s, and it was called New and Improved.
Yes, right.
And I noticed about a year ago a commercial for Tide, and it was called New and Improved.
Yeah, they've done it again,
Yeah, and I'm thinking, well, by now it ought to get up in the morning and make coffee for me if it's continually improved that much for that many years.
Yeah.
So what happens is a contemporaneity itself, the idea that newer is better and the old is passé, is a very important value for Madison Avenue. It's extremely critical to it, because that's what causes them to get you to sell a perfectly good automobile that you've had for 3 or 4 years, traded in on a newer model.
So let's get back to Johnny, who can't sing hymns. If he's been taught revolution, cast off the old, cast off the old, cast off the old, bring on the new, bring on the new. If he's been taught that for the last 25, 30, 35 years of his life, then what happens to his church music?
Well, what inevitably happens is he's so used to being passive regarding music, right?
Yes.
That is to say, he's not an active performer of it. Music is normally something that he observes, witnesses, listens to, maybe taps his foot along to, and this kind of a thing, claps a little. Music comes to him as a consumer thing, as a matter that he purchases according to his preference. Now, this is very different when music serves sacred functions, which is, by the way, if you ask a sociologist, the primary purpose it is served culturally. Most cultures, most of the music in most cultures serves a sacred purpose.
Mm.
And before you had electronic technologies and commercial interests therein, music almost always served a sacred purpose. Now, in such a setting, if the music was there as a means of meeting the divinity, you learned to conform to it. But if you're in a culture where music is primarily a commodity that is sold to you, your whole approach to it is, well, I like this more than that. I like watermelon more than cantaloupe, so I purchased a watermelon. I like this kind of music more than that kind of music, so I want that kind of music. So part of what we have to do is to kind of cut through all of that, right, and get back to the fact that in the particular setting of the sacredness of worship, we're not talking about a commodity. We're not talking about something that is a commercial choice driven by personal preference. We're talking about something that is driven by the commandment of God, who calls his people to sing his praise.
Yes.
And if we looked at the other things he commanded us to do in worship, to give attention to the word read and preached, to pray, or the sacraments, we would never even raise the question of personal preference. No one would say, for instance, well, our pastor's okay, pretty good preacher, but I prefer someone with a Scottish accent to someone with a Kentucky accent.
Yeah.
We would never think that such a silly thing should motivate us when it comes to preaching. We would want the person to be a good, sound expositor and organized, and if he did that, we wouldn't care about our preference for vocal styles. And we wouldn't with the sacraments. We wouldn't say, well, you know, I just preferred if they were to give a rose to the child instead of put water on his head at baptism. No one would ever think that because they prefer roses to water, that the sacrament should be driven by that.
Dr. Gordon, is there anything wrong with bringing contemporary music into the worship service if that's the form that the elders choose to use in the service?
Well, it's not unlawful if the elders choose to do it.
Yes.
And so it may be unwise, is the way I put it. It's certainly not unlawful to have living contemporary artists.
What would be your concern, though, if they went to a strictly contemporary service that was patterned after the pop music you find in the culture around us right now?
Well, the two concerns would be the cutting oneself off from the rest of the church.
Yeah.
And the second concern would be it just puts off the learning curve. If the problem is that we can no longer connect with the rest of the church in her hymnody, the only way we will learn to do it is at some point to do what I did with Brahms, make a little effort and learn how to do it.
Yes, yes.
And so there's a sense in which it's sort of like saying, suppose we told a preacher to preach 6-minute sermons so that the children could follow it. Well, okay, the great thing is the children could follow it. But how would they ever learn to listen to a 30-minute sermon? They would never learn to do it. So part of worship is learning to worship.
I think part of the teaching of the church is to mature the body of Christ in their knowledge and their cultural emanations. They've got to do both. They've got to somehow go down to wherever the culture is and raise the culture up and mature the culture. And that doesn't happen when you're constantly working at the lowest common denominator, whether in music, in content, in preaching, or whatever you're doing.
That's correct. See, in our culture, I refer to ours as a pedocentric culture, a child-centered culture.
Yes.
And that's just the opposite of a biblical culture where the goal of childhood in the Bible is to leave it behind you as soon as you possibly can. The Bible constantly praises those who are older and wiser. Paul says, when I was a child, I spoke and reasoned and thought as a child, but when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. And he says to the Corinthians to be babes at evil, but in your thinking, be mature. He's constantly urging people to be mature.
Yes.
Then our culture constantly urges them to be immature and thoughtless and impulsive and childish. And again, largely for commercial reasons. How do you get people to do impulse buying? You cultivate them as impulsive people.
Yes.
And so the commercial
great
forces
point.
Want us to be like children who just say, mine, mine, daddy, daddy, get one of those. They want us all to be that way. They don't want us to mature.
Yes.
And so that's what's behind it. But now, let me go back to the first part of my answer. Why would that concern me if we cut ourselves off?
Yes.
If we think of the analogy of the body of Christ, Kevin Swanson has gifts that David Gordon doesn't have. And on his good days, maybe David Gordon has one that Kevin Swanson doesn't.
Yes.
And Paul teaches us that we are all healthier when we are able to benefit from the gifts that God has given others. Well, now, if the church is 2,000 years old, and if we define a generation, as the Bible does, roughly by 40 years, then we are roughly at the point now where there have been 50 generations of Christendom.
Yes.
Now, let's assume that no particular generation of all of those, even my favorite, the 17th century German hymn writers, even that one, let's suppose that no generation has yet figured out hymnody perfectly. Well, then the best thing to do is expose ourselves to all the gifts of all the generations of the churches, so that if there's a blind spot in our generation, it's compensated for by another generation, which might have its own blind spot.
So a decent hymnal, in your estimation, would be a hymnal that would include something from Ambrose, something from the 5th century, the 8th century, the 10th century, the 12th century, the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries.
Yes. And in fact, I might even say that I wouldn't even attempt to do it every single week. I pastored for 9 years and didn't attempt to do this every week. But it wouldn't bother me if every week we had a psalm somewhere in the service to connect ourselves to the praise of those Old Testament saints. And it could be sung or unison or whatever. I wouldn't care. It would be great if we had a hymn from the ancient church, of the Father's Love Begotten, or O Gladsome Light, something like that.
Yes.
A medieval hymn, perhaps Bernard of Clairvaux's O Sacred Head, Now Wounded.
Yes.
A hymn from the Reformation Church, and a hymn from the Reformation, post-Reformation Church.
Yes, yes.
But what happened then is the peculiar strengths of the body of Christ and its peculiar weaknesses all blend together to edify us in a better way than if we do otherwise. So just think of this. If we're now in the 50th generation of the church, and we only listen to one generation's music, we are throwing out the gifts of 49 out of 50 Christians.
Well, and you speak.
Now, if you did that on a local level in a typical church of, let's say, 150 people, what that means is you would only be ministered to by three people in that church. You throw out all the others.
Yes, and in the end, you talk about the modern culture, modern musical forms as impoverished and weakened, and is there any wonder why the church is breaking down in the 21st century? We are perhaps the weakest, as far as a church is concerned, as we've been in the last 500 years since the Reformation, at least in my estimation.
Yeah, and if you look at the kind of material that is being sung, it is not ordinarily heretical. Which is damning with faint praise. That's a little bit like going to a restaurant and saying, I didn't get, transferable disease from the chef.
Yes.
If all you can say is he didn't kill me.
Right.
That's damning with faint praise,
right.
I would think.
Right.
It's not just merely that it's not heretical. The point is it rarely affirms anything that could be judged to be heretical.
Yes.
And so it tends to be as vapid and inconsequential as our culture is. And you mentioned Ken Myers before we came on the air. Ken Myers has essentially said that what distinguishes pop culture is its very banality, its insignificance, its triviality, its inconsequentiality. It's not that it's ugly, it's just that it's fairly inconsequential. And not surprisingly, then, if we want our church music to be analogous to it, our church music after a while becomes fairly inconsequential also.
And history itself is insignificant and unimportant to the average person. You make the point, I think a very strong point in the book, that that today people are looking at the news and listening to the news, and their lives are framed by this, and Lindsay Lohan's jail time is more important than Patrick Henry's Stamp Act resolutions 200 years ago, because whatever's happening, whatever's changing in the present day is the most important, most significant thing, and who cares what happened in history? It just doesn't have an impact on people anymore. They don't care.
Yeah, that's right. We've been trained to be contemporaneous by the commercial forces because, again, that's their way of selling us what is new. If they can create in us either a benign neglect of the past or even an overt contempt for it, either one works for them.
Yes.
It can even be a benign neglect where we say such things as, well, that was nice for them back in those days when they rode horses to work. Even if it's a benign neglect, it has the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
If they can teach us that we can live a perfectly good and wise and fulfilling life by being cut off from all of previous civilization, then they can sell us the new routinely.
Yes.
So I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want people to shave as I do with a 1904 Gillette double-edged razor.
Yes.
Because they don't make any money off the replacement blades off of it.
Right.
They're so inexpensive.
Right. Right.
And so I save about $70 to $80 a year by using a razor that my father and or grandfather could have used. It works absolutely as well as any contemporary razor, but they don't make any money off of it.
Dr. David Gordon, and the book is Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. Dr. Gordon, before we're done, we have to, I think, give people a sense for where we're going here. And we do need to hang on to the old. It's absolutely essential to maintain, I believe, this generational continuity from previous generations in our family life, as well as in the larger Christian historical pattern from years past. But how do we hang on to the old? How do we retain the heritage that we've received in past generations while at the same time not stagnating in our culture and singing a new song to the Lord? So I see there's a both and here. How do we connect the generations?
Well, one of the things that I would suggest is my understanding of those psalms about singing new songs are references to new acts of redemptive history in which we ought to write new psalms about them. So I'm not so sure that there's any biblical mandate that says that we have to write a new song for its own sake.
Yes.
However, I do think gifted Christian artists in every generation ought to express themselves artistically, informed by their Christian vision, which means in every generation we would expect some hymn writers to show up. So that's fine. My point would be this. In no previous generation of the church did we feel such an impulse to, quote, connect to the youth.
Yes.
In every previous generation, young people were expected to grow out of it. And they were proud when they did. I can still remember tying my first tie. It was a vertical tie at the time. I now tie bow ties. But I can still remember how proud I was to tie my own tie when I went to church on Sunday morning rather than to have a clip on. And I think I still remember my first suit rather than just a little sports coat and something like that, my first actual suit. Because that's what my father wore as a businessman, a real suit. And so through all of human history until about 30 years ago, what we did is we cordially opened our arms to the youth and said, here's what adult people do, and we welcome you to join us as soon as you prove yourself responsible to.
Yes.
And now many people think that we have to take a different tack and say to young people, we want to be like you. But to me, that's like Jesus saying to the rich young man, let me give you some money. The last thing a young person needs is any more encouragement to be adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be encouraged to be adult.
Yes.
And to be responsible. So the last thing we do in ministering to them is to tell them it's fine for them to remain as youthful people, cut off from everything but their own adolescent ghetto. They live in Lord of the Flies.
Mm-hmm.
Their electronic technologies, their Twitters, their Facebook, their texting and so forth, put them in their own adolescent ghetto, more so than any previous generation. They are cut off from the world of adults.
Well, we appreciate the interview with you, Dr. David Gordon. Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. Incredibly important concepts, ideas on this edition of Generations. I believe if we salvage the culture, if we're going to salvage civilization, if we're going to salvage the church and church music in the years to come, we have to reconsider the way we've been teaching our youth in the area of music. And your contribution to this discussion has been invaluable. Thank you very much, Dr. Gordon. We appreciate you.
Thanks very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
A lot of information shared on this edition of Generations, folks. We want to connect ourselves with church history. We want to take hymnody vitally seriously because this is the way that we praise God and the way we continue to build the church of Jesus Christ from generation to generation. And we've got to link the generations in the way we do our culture. I want my great-grandchildren worshiping in my church with me, if God gives me that much time here. I would love to see great-grandparents and great-grandchildren worshiping in the same church together with the same worship service, the same culture, the same music. Is this possible? I suggest to you that it is. Stay tuned in, folks, to this Generations Radio broadcast as we continue to bring this vision to you each and every day. You can interact with the show by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. You can also hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.